Welcome to the inaugural podcast of Education Matters New York. My name is Wayne Ackles, and I will be your host and guide in the coming weeks and months to this new endeavor. I am incredibly excited to bring this to those who have chosen to listen. As this is our maiden podcast, I wanted to take a moment to tell you briefly about myself and what this podcast will try to do. So let's begin. As I stated at the beginning of the podcast, my name is Wayne Ackles, and I have 30 years of experience in New York State public education as a teacher, coach, class advisor, and spent the last 13 years of my career as an administrator at the high school and middle school levels. The bulk of my career was in the Western New York, Finger Lakes, Rochester region. I have roots in Central New York and did some work for a bit in the Syracuse suburbs. My teaching specialization was social studies. I instructed students across the entire spectrum, from struggling learners to those in dual enrollment programs, specifically with Syracuse University and their SUPA program. As an administrator, I worked in two large suburban districts, Fairport and West Genesee, and a small rural district, both as a teacher and administrator, Honeoye Central School. And Honeoye is located at the northern end of Honeoye Lake, not to be confused with the school I did my student teaching at, which was Honeoye Falls Lima. I'm currently a training coordinator for a local construction company in the Rochester region. I have found a way to continue to teach in my semi-retired status, and I will share more of my experiences, both past and current, to shape the issues that we're talking about on the podcast with some context. So let's talk a little bit about what this podcast is about. First, I hope this will be a resource to administrators and teachers who are looking to hear from people that I trust on issues and expertise that are unique and have also done the work in the trenches and or are continuing to do the work in the trenches of public education. The episodes will not be a professional development on specific strategies for addressing a particular issue. Those exist or can be found in other formats. This is really meant to be a meeting place for experienced professionals looking to hear from and potentially connect with other professionals. I also hope to bring issues to lay people who want to know more about how schools operate in plain and frank language. The goal will be to provoke thought and make us all question our assumptions about what we want schools to be and do. I don't have all the answers. I hope to ask thoughtful questions and lead you to some resources that can better answer those questions and hopefully give you a deeper understanding on what schools do and what they can be. And finally, I want to be a bit of a cheerleader for the concept of public education. There are very few institutions left where there is a community-based common experience. We live very niche lives now, from everything from our entertainment streaming experiences to how we gather information. When you do a search, it's often been algorithmically cultivated to our unique taste and the cliques that we belong to. Public schools are one of the last places that bring diverse communities, and I mean that in all the forms that we could mean in, with diverse, that one can imagine, from someone's cultural background to your whether or not your family are gun owners or not, and everything in between. And together, those different backgrounds exchange and learn from each other, and it's one of the last safe places where that can happen. So as I stated earlier, this will be based upon my experience, but also the mentoring I received and the perspective that I've cultivated over the years as an educator. You won't hear me say that this is my truth. The T word gets thrown around a great deal in various contexts, and I think it does disservice to the word truth. So you won't hear me call it my truth, but I'll refer to it more as my experience or experiences or what I've seen in the various roles I've had over the years in public education. Now that the introductions and guardrails for the show are in place, let's talk a little bit about format. Each episode will have headlines brought from a variety of sources that highlight education issues both in the state and around the nation. There may be a theme that relates or doesn't relate to the guest, or it may just be the most interesting articles of the week. There will typically be a guest that will take most of the time and sometimes all of the time that we have for a particular episode. I'll try to spend some time also with some mentoring thoughts when there's time enough within the episode for that. The goal is to spend about 45 minutes to an hour on each episode together. And if you were like me in a couple of my last gigs, you may have a commute, and it's nice to have a companion on the drive where you can do some thinking and have a companion. And hopefully my guests and I will provide that companionship on your commute if you have a longer commute home. So let's get started. No guests today, but let's take a look at some of the headlines making news, and I'll give you some comments and thoughts on that, and that will give you a sense of what the news aspects of the podcast will look like. We'll have our guest on our next show. I've been cultivating guests here for a while now, and our first guest will probably join us within the next couple of weeks, so very excited about that, but I'll introduce that guest when the time is right. So let me start with some news that made the rounds this week, and our first headline is from Monday, December 13th, Education Week, and the headline is "Schools Face Fear of Critical Race Theory as They Scale Up Social Emotional Learning," and that was an article presented by Ariana Prothero and Evie Blad. This article brought up some very interesting tidbits, and what my goal is to kind of give you a quick synopsis on any one of these articles, and then leave you to, you know, find out a little bit more about it, and I'll give you my thoughts on it, and maybe it'll give you some interest to search out the article and see if it's something that may apply to you and your district, or something that you've had some interest in finding out more about. But I found the article an interesting article on this and the issues that it brought up. And the basic gist of the article was that schools have been increasing their investment in social-emotional learning, both as a result of the trauma of the pandemic and the general sense of anxiety in the country. But as they've made these investments and added program and funding to it, there's been many districts that fear a backlash that those programs will wrongly be associated with critical race theory, because the problem has, the public has had difficulty and problems understanding what social emotional learning is. The article at one point said that they quoted someone that stated that, parents will know what reading, writing, and arithmetic is, but social emotional learning is a little bit more abstract than what the typical parent thinks of in terms of when it comes to raising their child. And sometimes that becomes a source of anxiety and also a potential opening for fears of things like a misunderstanding of critical race theory being associated with this, etc. And, you know, one of the things that I found interesting in not only reading but reflecting on the article is that, you know, this social emotional learning and the trauma that many of our students have been facing, both with the pandemic, but also prior to the pandemic. And those of us that have been in education for some time, you know, the writing has been on the wall for a while about the increasing levels of anxiety. And as schools have tried to adjust and work with students with a variety of backgrounds and issues and things that they bring on a daily basis, they've done some pretty creative things. One of the things that one of my former bosses did, and he's going to be a guest on the show in the near future, is to create a model of community outreach, bringing social, emotional learning and counseling for families on off hours, and making a commitment through community partnering to allow, you know, parents and families to come in to get counseling services at the school outside of regular school hours. And that had some powerful implications as the program went on. The need continues to grow, and that need, as I said a minute ago, has been growing for some time now. And some of it has been some of the change in the economic fortunes for families, especially after the crash of 08-09 and just the reorganization of the economy over time. But it also has been an issue of access. And some of that issue of access comes from not only, a change in benefits for families and a lack of income, but also it comes from, frankly, a lack of practitioners. There are just not the same number of mental health folks that there used to be, and maybe probably that's the wrong way to look at it. It's not a question of the number hasn't changed that drastically in terms of the number of providers. The reality is that as the need has increased, the number of providers have not kept pace. So an example of this is in the mental health realm of the mental health emergency room. And when a student or a young person is in crisis, or frankly, for that matter, an adult's in crisis, the wait period could be as long as a 24-hour wait period to be admitted, evaluated, etc., in a mental health emergency room. Now, that's a pretty significant delay in getting help for someone that is experiencing a mental health crisis. Along with that delay, what also comes from that is also added trauma as someone waits with a variety of different people with different crises and different symptoms. And that can be pretty traumatic, especially for young people. And it's an exhausting experience for both the child and their family. And many times the diagnosis or the evaluation that comes back after that 24 hours is that everything is okay because it has been such a long delay from the original onset of symptoms. And many times when the school has been the one to help bring the situation to light, schools are often surprised to find the student right back at school the following day without any kind of follow-up from the mental health providers, because the diagnosis that came back was that of that there was not a significant reason for concern. And so that leads to more frustration between the family and often the school, because, you know, the school has tried to build trust and has tried to be an honest broker with a family and said, you know, we've seen something that is concerning to us, and it doesn't always get the follow-through that one hopes for in the emergency department. And again, given that delay, it's not a surprise, but it's incredibly frustrating for everybody. And so as schools try to bridge that gap and provide different opportunities, at my last district in West Tennessee, we were trying to find a better way to partner with families, especially as the pandemic was going on. And we were starting to have some success with that as well, in terms of trying to speed the admission process to get them in for regular counseling and, again, create a space right within the school for families to meet at a variety of times during the day. And at that time, we were still largely meeting during the day, but it's very possible that they have shifted to an evening set of hours as well. And at the beginning of this segment, you know, I started to mention, you know, the lack of access and how some of the economic factors could play a role. And you can see some of this when you look at the growth of the free and reduced population of students in many districts. Free and reduced lunch population is one of the measures that schools often use to measure the poverty rate of the community. And basically, it's based on federal guidelines that show whether a student can receive aid, whether it is to get completely free lunch or to get a reduced price in that lunch. And as an example, you know, at Fairport, I worked there for 18 years, and that's an eastern suburban district in the outskirts of Rochester. And it's considered a fairly wealthy enclave of the eastern suburbs, not probably considered the wealthiest, but also definitely not considered by most people as a poverty-stricken district. And one of the things that changed over time is that the free and reduced lunch population, from the beginning of my time at Fairport until the time that I left, it changed from around 7% to approximately 18%. Now, that's a pretty significant change when you consider that it's a district that, again, is considered fairly well off. If you know the geography of the eastern suburbs, generally speaking, those are considered fairly wealthy districts. And as a result, this change just highlights some of the factors that can result in, you know, having difficulties in getting more access to mental health services, co-pays, etc. So as those financial resources become, you know, less, it becomes much more difficult for families to find a way to, you know, pay those co-pays. Or if they can afford those co-pays, then there is the added whammy of having access. And it really, you know, becomes quite a fraught process for everybody. And I'm hoping that, you know, as more attention is paid to the social emotional learning and schools continue to bring that up, and people look at the trauma created from the pandemic and a number of the issues that have come up in the last going on 2 years now, that there's some funding that heads the way of not only districts, but some, you know, to communities to help bolster their mental health support, because it's very difficult to teach learners that are struggling with mental health issues, and parents are really, you know, often, you know, at a loss for how to help with that. So going to shift gears here a little bit to a couple of other articles that I saw, and both of these came out of the News 10 TV station out of Albany. And the Albany newspapers and TV stations are a great resource for breaking news out of state ed. And those of us that get the bulletins from the New York State Education Department, NYSED. You'll hear me refer to it from time to time in the coming shows. If you don't get those bulletins, sometimes you wouldn't know otherwise some of these things that are going on out of Albany. And there were two pieces of news that actually, I'm surprised, weren't more newsworthy across the state and seemed to only make a blip in the Albany market. And the first one, I think, potentially has some devastating consequences depending on how the follow-up happens for it. And essentially what the story was is that the New York State Ed Department will no longer offer the task for the high school equivalency. The short version of this story, and it was actually a fairly short story, is that as of December 31st, the task exam will no longer be used for high school equivalency. Now, for those of you that have not heard of the task exam replaced the GED a number of years ago. I believe it was around 2014. And as with many of the exams that New York State gives for its students, whether it is some of the K through 8, actually I should say, excuse me, 3 through 8 exams, not so much the Regents, even though the consultations for that came from the College Board, but the 3 through 8 exams and some of the other exams like the TASC have been subcontracted out to different educational companies that create the exams, and the corporation that is responsible for the task has decided that they're going to take their efforts elsewhere and are no longer going to provide that as of December 31st. Knowing how long the process can take for policy to change or a new tool to be adopted by NYSED, this is a pretty big development, and I'm looking forward to reaching out to a couple of guidance counselor colleagues of mine, and also a couple administrators that are still working to see what schools are looking to do, because that relief valve of the task often is one of the last places for students that don't always quite, you know, the square peg in the round hole of high school, and they make it to their sophomore and junior year, and they're hanging on by a thread, and sometimes the task is the light at the end of the tunnel that they need to get on with the rest of their life and create new opportunities for themselves in a variety of ways. One of the things that this podcast is going to explore is some of those different alternatives for students and looking at that non-traditional student. You know, schools get a lot of credit, and I think rightfully so, for the traditional student. I was fortunate to teach a lot of those types of students over the years. The ones that test well, they're interested in school, they come with a lot of background knowledge in their back pocket, and school is a joy for them. They find a lot of value in it. But there is a population of students that does not fit the mold. And as an administrator, I found that more and more I gravitated toward those students and trying to find alternatives and different ways and different paths for them to be successful. And one of the things that I really want to explore with this podcast, and I think I've gained a different insight on that now that I work in the construction business, and just to give you a little bit of the background, the construction company that I work for, a great deal of the work that it does, it basically takes up 80 to 85% of the workload that the construction company does is in natural gas pipeline and distribution, in the sense that it puts main pipelines down and also connects to homes, et cetera, you know, in a subdivision or something along those lines. And in order to do that work, you have to be qualified to do that with these operational qualifications, these OQs, as we call them. And the OQs, many of them have two parts. One part, as you can imagine, and makes a lot of sense, are hands-on. You have to show and demonstrate that you can properly put the different pieces of pipe and service tees and valves, etc., together and make sure that they're operational. But before you can do that, there is also a written component. And some of these test questions can be difficult for many of these grown adults. There's men and women that work in this. It's still largely a male-dominated profession, but it's difficult for many of these folks. And that's been something that where I've been working to try to make that a little bit easier for those folks. But the point of that is that it has given me a new appreciation for what we consider blue-collar work, and that we often don't expose students to those opportunities. And for years, as both a teacher and an administrator, one of the things that I felt very strongly is that we do very well on the notion of, when we talk about college and career ready, we do very well with schools on the college side of it. Because schools are built for that. And we're built for exams and reading and writing and those kind of things. But it becomes much more difficult when creating the paths for those that might want to create a career that really doesn't need a four-year college degree. Sometimes a two-year degree, but that hands-on learner struggles to find the niche in public education, even if they are a BOCES student. It's a very narrow path. It's really 2 years, the last 2 years of their college, or excuse me, the last 2 years of their high school career. And it frankly, I think it sells them short. And I'm hoping that as time goes on, that there's more attention to that. And at some point when it's appropriate, this is not the time because we're starting to run up against some time constraints on this episode, but I'll give you the, if Wayne was king of the world, how he would look at what has historically been called vocational education and how we can do it better. The other news article that came out of the News 10 Albany News Station was that, and again, I think this is a fairly important study, or excuse me, an important story, and I noticed a headline that reflected something similar in Indiana, that the state ed was not going to require something known as the EdTPA, which is the exam that new teachers need to take in order to get their qualifications, and that they were going to be exploring new options to help people get certified and, you know, become brought into the profession of teaching. There were a variety of steps. Part of it was a test. Part of it was filming a lesson and then turning that in. Let me be blunt and to the point on this. I think it was well-intentioned, but I think what got lost is that it became another bureaucratic hurdle versus something that truly helped make sure that, you know, solid teachers got into the profession. One of the things that I found disappointing as my time as an administrator continued was I would often see the requirements that were coming in from local colleges as they would ask for time with teachers, for students to shadow and ultimately student teach, but the number of visitation hours they needed before they could student teach. So any of the local colleges that may end up picking up on this podcast, for what it's worth, I'm not sure that 100 hours of visitations and watching someone teach are the most helpful. There is value in seeing a skilled professional do what they do. And I would not sell that short, but I think there becomes a point of diminishing returns. And there are other methods of getting at more productive time for those folks. In fact, I would argue that some of that time could be in picking up content so that there's confidence in the content area so that they know those students and those future teachers have a confidence in knowing the content and therefore can then apply the pedagogical skills that they're learning confidently on a topic that they feel comfortable with. You know, I remember from my own, I said at the top of the show that my experience is in social studies, and I'll never forget when I got my first job at Honeoye Central School, and I was told that I'd be teaching a section of economics. Well, again, I was very excited to get the job, but I also knew that I was a history major with a poli-sci minor, or excuse me, a poli-sci concentration and an English minor. The prospect of teaching economics, I'll be honest, terrified me. I ended up enjoying it as one of my favorite classes to teach. But to say that I was confident in that, those first few lessons, that would have definitely not characterized how I was feeling about it. And I think there is something to be said. And I'm not saying that they have to, you know, get hours and hours and hours of more instruction either, but I'm not sure that hours and hours and hours of observation time is going to be the most productive either. And, you know, there, I think there's a revamping, and I know that there's been a push literally for decades to professionalize the teaching world. And I think we've made great strides in a lot of ways around that, not only in how we teach and what we teach, but also the standards we hold people to. But I think we have also made the gate much harder to get in, and that has created some of the shortages that we're facing right now. I many times felt for new teachers as they came in under the new guidelines. And I wondered, you know, looking back at 22-year-old Wayne, if I would have made it, because 22-year-old Wayne was allowed to make a lot of mistakes as a young teacher, and it still turned out pretty well in the long run. But I'm not sure with some of the evaluation processes and even just the gatekeeping to get into the profession that I'm not sure I'm fully confident that I would have stuck it out, because there is a point where I think young people are looking at this saying, you know, the pay is still not great compared to other professions with the level of education that you have. And it becomes a hurdle, and people are passionate that get into this business, but, that passion can get, you know, beaten out of you pretty quickly, with some of the bureaucratic hurdles. So I think this is a good move, and I'm looking forward to see how that process changes and, some of the directions that come from NAP. So that is the end of our first episode. I know I said at the beginning that we would spend 45 minutes together. I'll be cutting this episode a little bit short because we won't have a guest today. Please feel free to send me your thoughts and comments. My website that will be accompanying this podcast, we'll make mention of later. And so with that, I will wrap up this episode of Education Matters New York. This has been a Ackles Enterprise Fat Wolverine Productions venture. And thank you again for taking the time to listen. If you were listening today, tell friends and family and fellow educators about this. I promise that as we get guests, these episodes will only get better. And it'll be not just me always pontificating on different ideas around public education. Again, thank you for your time. And as we get closer to the Christmas and New Year season, happy holidays for those that have celebrated Hanukkah. Hopefully you had a great Hanukkah as well. And take care, be well, be good to each other. And we will see you again on Education Matters New York.